With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my interview today is with Ann Shin. She's a returning guest to Face to Face, and we talk about her new film, My Enemy, My Brother. And if you want to learn more about that, My Enemy, My Brother movie. .com. You can find out the awards that Anne has won with this film, where it's going to be playing coming up soon in Montreal and Vancouver and Edmonton, where she's been coming back from the UN and The Hague. And we had just such a marvelous time together. We talked about miracles and serendipity. We talked about PTSD and trauma and the healing of wounds and about the other. We had this great conversation around what it means to be a neighbor here in Canada, to be a global neighbor, kind of based largely on a quote by Stéphane Dion at a recent event that Anne attended. She was on a panel discussion where Stéphane Dion was there alongside and had some really interesting things to say about trust and about hope and about, as he said, finding a piece of blue sky in the storm of war. I think you're going to really enjoy this interview today, and you do need to see the film, so check it out online or try to check it out in a coming soon to a theater near you. And if you're interested in what I'm up to, patreon.com, check us out online there. You can get behind Face to Face and support the work that we're doing there. And we've launched and have close to, I think, 360, 365 interviews online. So check us out there, facetofacelive.ca, for more information. Coming right up, Ann Shin talking about her film, My Enemy, My Brother. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We are joined by a returning, very special guest here. Ann Shin is here today to talk about her film, My Enemy, My Brother. And I even have an acronym now for the film, so that's fantastic. And thank you so much, this beautiful, sunny, gorgeous spring day here in Toronto.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's great to be back talking with you.
So it's been over a year, I think, mm-hmm. since we had a conversation. And as I was making my way here today to chat, I kind of thought, you know, sometimes I think theme, sometimes I think, you know, let's talk about subject matter, about the, you know, the film or the book or the essay or the initiative or whatever it is my guest is into. But I think there's a fair bit of history, mm-hmm. You know, that's happened since the film mm-hmm. Was finished. I'm sure we've got some new listeners. So maybe a couple questions right out of the gate. Tell us a little bit about what's been going on with the film. And you're just back from The Hague and a couple festivals, which is incredible. Love that. Uber congratulations on all that stuff.
Thank you.
So, I'd love to hear some of that anecdotal stuff. But also, maybe you can just bring our listeners up to speed on M-E-M-B.
Sure. Okay. M-E-M-B, My Enemy, My Brother, is a documentary that follows two men, former enemies from the Iran-Iraq War. And so Najah was an Iraqi soldier who was saved by Zahed, an Iranian soldier, during battle. And Zahed was a child soldier who risked his life to save Najah. And then by sheer coincidence, 20 years later, they meet again in Canada. And so I follow them as that kind of miraculous meeting triggers a further search for their family back in Iraq and an attempt to reunify with family in Iran as well. And so we finished the feature film, and it debuted at Hot Docs to sold out audiences. It was wonderful. And it's been touring through festivals, and it was at The Hague, and it was screening in Berlin, and also screened at the UN Human Rights Council. And that was a great screening, great conversation about the importance of freedom of religion and religious views, and how it impacts society, and migrants and refugees.
So many questions.
Yeah.
So many questions. I mean, it's a great film, and it's a film that I hope everybody sees for so many reasons. And what I think I love about documentary and just storytelling in general, it's so layered.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a film, and I want to ask you if you believe in miracles. Let's get to that in a second.
Yeah.
But and serendipity. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yes.
This chance, like meeting, right?
Yes,
and,
it is.
And where does determinism and all those things fall into play? But it's just such a beautiful film about friendship and about family and about hope and redemption and peace and the list kind of goes on, really, doesn't it? It's not about just these two men who by chance met in the middle of the Iran-Iraq War.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we follow them. We're deep in, we meet their family. Najah meets family he hasn't seen in 3 decades, and they're kissing and hugging and crying, and we're in and amongst them, and there's kids underfoot, and it's just, it's full of the richness of life that happens. And we get a really, we're privileged to kind of get a really intimate view of what it's like to live in Iraq now. And what it has been like to be living in Iraq during decades of conflict, ongoing conflict.
Do you believe in miracles?
I believe that there is a reason why things happen.
Right.
So
yep.
I think that there's often some reason why there might be a serendipitous encounter, or it often leads to something really great, and it did so with these guys, yeah.
So just to be clear, they bump into each other in the middle. They're enemies.
Yes.
They bump into each other. The one saves the other's life at great risk.
Yes.
To himself.
Yeah.
Probably, maybe even execution.
Mm-hmm.
They end up becoming prisoners of war, separated for many, many years.
Ironically, on either side of the war, they're held by each other's armies.
Right,
Mm-hmm.
And then some 20-some years or 30 years later, meet in Vancouver.
Yeah, in a counseling center.
Hang on, Anne, did you make this up?
I know. No, I wouldn't, because no editor would be like, oh. This is crap. No one's going to believe it.
Nobody's going to believe this story.
This is just too contrived.
Yeah.
But it was phenomenal. Like, they met, and at first they didn't recognize each other.
Right.
But then they were like saying, oh, so you were in the war too. And funny, I was a prisoner of war too, ironically. And then they're going on, and I was in that battle. And then one the other says, in that battle, actually someone saved me, this young soldier. He was too young to even have a beard yet. And that's when the other soldier, Zahed, was like,
getting goosebumps.
Yeah.
Like, it's
that soldier, he was like, was me. You have a line of stitches across your belly button. You have teeth missing in your upper left side of your mouth. Like, he identified all the wounds that Najah had. And that's how they didn't believe it at first either of them. But happened.
I love how, I'd love to hear a little bit about this too, about the history of how the film came to be, the New York Times op-ed piece that you were nominated for an Oscar for, I believe.
Nominated for an Emmy and shortlisted for an Oscar.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
Thank you.
And I want to come back to that notion of identifying the wounds, because to me that's sort of what this film is really all about, this sort of long-term effect, the PTSD, the trauma, the wounds that we all carry, frankly.
For sure.
Right?
For sure.
And not, you know, we're all fighting our own wars of one kind or another, it seems to me. But so New York Times, you know, you end up getting the full length feature, and I'm not sure if this appears in both the short and the full length, but I love the moment where they meet and they talk about how they each mistook each other for a different nationality.
Yeah.
So the Iranian says, "Oh, you're an Iranian." Mm-hmm. "No, actually, I'm Iraqian." Yeah. "Well, aren't you Iraqi?" "No, I'm Iranian."
Yeah.
I love that moment. Yeah. It's such an important moment for me about this idea. And we're going to come back to this whole idea of neighbor, too, I hope, before the end of the interview. But yeah, the validation of the other and also how easy it is to disregard. You know, "Oh, you must be Iraqi." "No, actually, I'm not. I'm Iranian."
Yeah, I think it points to two things that, you know, we can think about here. One is like that this can happen in a country like Canada, who's received refugees. These two men were enemies and their countries were warring. But here they're both refugees and they've settled into their lives in Canada, and they can meet in a peaceful time and, you know, be in a calm and peaceful, safe environment enough to just notice each other and begin a conversation on a friendly level and mistake each other for the same kind of ethnic background or same national, you know, background. So that's one thing about how it's a testament to countries that receive refugees from conflict zones and allow them to start lives again. The other thing, though, is that it's a real kind of a real remarkable story about something that happens all across the globe, enemies that will meet again in redemptive times, or how people will find redemption from trauma, and particularly war trauma. I know there's a project you're working on that's following a fellow who was involved with Khmer Rouge, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that this kind of story about the possibility of redemption is kind of universal, and that's the other thing that's quite moving about having followed.
Well, it's interesting. Thanks for his name, Soon, by the way. But what's interesting about Soon is in the Khmer Rouge, it's all about memory, and your film's about memory as well,
and about
finding their way home.
Yeah.
And this is what's so beautiful about the second sort of phase of the, or the, I don't know if you would call it the second part of the film or the second part of the story, but how they go back home to try to connect with their roots and remember.
Yeah. I think memory is really important in healing wounds, obviously, and redemption, particularly on a national level as well as on a personal level. So someone like Najah, one, kind of blocked out his past because it was so traumatic. He was a prisoner of war for 17 years and, you know, suffered a lot of atrocity and torture.
Mm-hmm.
But it was when he met Zahed that he thought, "Oh my goodness, my missing wife and son. Like, if I can meet this soldier who saved my life 20 years ago, maybe there's still hope for me to meet my wife and son." And that's what made him want to go back to Iraq. And what happens is that he's able to heal some of the old war wounds, the post-traumatic stress syndrome that he suffered from. He was able to start to heal that because he was able to confront it finally and to address and express some of the traumas that he had lived through, you know, years ago, decades ago.
Mm-hmm. I think when Najah is relating the story, I think maybe it's Sahad, but when he's wounded, he comes across him and finds his Quran, I believe.
Yes.
And as he's flipping through it, obviously you would think there would be a respect there on both sides, immediate respect of some kind, and you sort of communicate that without a doubt. But then he stumbles on, to speak of memory, he stumbles on flipping through a photo.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the line was right away he changed into a human. I mean, it's such a beautiful line.
Yeah.
And it was, I think Zahed saying, it was sort of at that moment that I decided I'm not going to kill this man, or I'm not going to leave him to bleed out and die. Mm-hmm. I'm going to save his life.
Yes, yeah. Because up until that point, Naja was just another faceless enemy soldier in a bunker full of wounded and dead enemy soldiers. And Zahed's duty was to kill anyone who was left alive. And Naja was just another...
Can you imagine giving that order?
Yeah.
Like, it's just mind-boggling, right?
Yes.
You're just going to make sure everybody's dead. Anyway, sorry to interrupt, but it's just mind-boggling.
So, and Zahed was a child soldier at the time.
Right.
It was quite the task. And he was going through the bunker, and he finds Naja, who is alive. But it's true, like, until he saw the photo, which was a photo of Naja's wife and son. Like, suddenly he became human. Changed into, it's true. Like, suddenly it was like, oh my God, like, this man is just a bit older than me. He has a wife and a little baby, just like my older brothers. And, you know, suddenly he could relate again. And that is, I think, the thing that's so inspiring about their story, that moment of humanity and connection could interrupt, you know, what happens in war. For these two men, and it changes their lives forever.
It's remarkable in a way to think of it as an argument for hope, in a sense,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
the whole film mm-hmm. is that, and their story, and going back, and the bumping into each other. I mean, the serendipity of it all, right? The hopefulness of that. But I so love the fact that what you just said, that in the middle of this utter chaos, madness, this evil, you know, let's use as many words as we can here, right, to mm-hmm. describe how horrific the situation must have been. Mm-hmm. And you bring out in the film that this was a pretty horrible, messy war.
Yeah.
It
was the longest conventional war of the 20th century.
Yeah, wow,
Chemical weapons were used, and it was atrocious.
I so love, though, that you bring out this notion that in the middle of that, there was still this opportunity to hope.
Yes.
And that something occurred that it wasn't so bad that Zahed and Naja couldn't sort of work through it.
For sure, yes. We had a screening at the Berlin, you know, the Canadian Embassy in Berlin. And the ambassador to Germany, Stefan Dion, had spoke about it. And
I'm glad you bring him up. I want to quote him.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
You can quote him.
Okay, is this the same quote?
Yes.
Okay, maybe it might be.
Yeah.
So, quote, "What strikes me is the humanity of these two men. From their example, we see that even at the worst of times, the best in people may be revealed. This movie is fundamentally optimistic." Nice. "And we need this optimism. Otherwise, what remains is complete despair. And we need hope, because hope is the necessary motive for action, progress, and improvement." Close quote. Wow. Stefan Dion, ambassador to Canada for Germany. Wow, what a beautiful quote. I was going to quote him as well, very similarly to that, or similar to that quote, but maybe I'll bring that back near the end. But so he spoke that to the room?
Mm-hmm. He did.
In the introduction? Was this in the Q&A?
Yes, in the introduction.
Right.
And it was a great screening where there were the secretary to the state, I believe, of Berlin, and then there was an immigration minister, and there were community groups. They were all talking about the influx of migrants and refugees into Germany, but also into Europe. So it was a discussion about inclusion of migrants and refugees.
Inclusion.
And just,
There we go.
Yeah, and some of the big challenges that are facing migrants in Europe now.
Isn't that kind of what Dion is saying in the quote, and what you're saying through the film, and I hope through the work that I'm doing, and I hope, I mean, is this idea that of our who actually is our neighbor?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So here we are in your house in Toronto. Mm-hmm. Is it next door to the left of us, to the right of us, to across the road, or is it? Is it, you know, 10,000 kilometers away, potentially?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
we live. What does global village mean anymore? Yeah. What is, the world is flat? You know, Friedman says the world is flat. I'm not even sure what that means yet.
Right.
But again, back to this notion of humanity and hope.
Yeah, I would say that your neighbor is someone who you know and feel a sense of community with, and would, you know, kind of feel like you're part of a kind of a society with them. And that would mean, you know, whether that neighbor is a refugee from another country,
yeah,
or someone who's lived in the in this country for, you know, two generations, or who's lived here for 20 years or 30 years, or perhaps your neighbor is also people of another country who are related to someone you care about in your physical neighborhood. Like, I think that that might be the one, the way one might understand the term global village.
So it's like, not a question of proximity.
I don't think so. No, I think it's an approach to others around you, and being aware, not just of, you know, your own corner of the world, but your own, your role in world, your role and responsibility as a world citizen.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's interesting that you brought Dion up. I was going to quote him, and then I read, I guess it was, I might have read the introduction even online, but he actually says we're neighbors. Maybe in the speech, that, the introduction, or maybe it was post or an article about, but he refers. Hard to convince people of that, it seems to me. I mean, it's a lot has happened since we last talked, and easy to Trump bash, easy to go after the U.S., but you know what? I'm not convinced that we're that much different up here in Canada, or maybe in the West is a better way to put it, when you look at what is happening in Berlin, in Europe, and this desire to sort of, it seems, hold the other out.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Got to protect ourselves right here. Yeah. Inclusion's okay as long as we only go so far, right?
Well, you think about the history of Iraq, and I mean, I think this is where it's interesting to talk about the role of memory and knowing of history to understand how we are neighbors, how we are all related, in fact. Like, we in North America think of Iraq as this other country where a lot of violence goes down, a lot of conflict, ISIS came out of there, like, you know, that's how we see Iraq, as those people, right?
Yeah, no, for sure.
But in fact, we had a hand in creating, you know, the situation in which ISIS could flourish and you know, and become a political force. If you think of just what Najah says in the film, he says, you know, the Iran-Iraq war, which is, takes us back to the 80s, was a proxy war. He doesn't say the word proxy war, but he says that it was the Americans versus the Russians. They were the ones who started the fire, he says.
Right.
And we were the wood in the fire. Because we bought weapons from America, and the others bought weapons from Russia. And then we killed each other with their weapons. And it was, you know, this unrest that caused, you know, a vacuum and a debilitation of infrastructure in Iraq. And that's how ISIS could start in Iraq. And of course, I'm not even talking about the Gulf Wars that happened. There's a lot of American involvement there. There was also some Canadian involvement, British and French involvement. And we're not even talking about the British involvement in the Middle East, you know, prior, like early part of the 20th century and late 19th
now we're
century.
Now we're getting into a class lecture essay on colonialism.
I know, right?
And I know that some people just turn off when you use the phrase.
Exactly.
Right? But
it's just like we're guilty.
Covered in blood.
Yeah, exactly.
Covered
we're part
blood.
Of this.
Yeah.
We created. Yeah. We're part of creating the situation. So it's not Iraq's problem.
Well,
you know,
about,
we are neighbors. Yeah,
Vietnam,
exactly.
And Cambodia, and Laos, something near and dear to my heart.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's what drew me in, was the complicity of it all.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Singapore with Elizabeth, my wife, not at the time. She was teaching. A friend of hers comes back, spends 3 days in Cambodia. She's in tears. She's showing me actual pictures, by the way, not digital, so like actual prints of her trip that she had done at a 24-hour booth.
Those were the days. Hold the pictures in your hand.
Yeah. Speaking of sort of, I guess it's still digital memory, but still the what is it, the simulacra, John Baudrillard would say. But anyway, and it was so touched. And so for the next 3 days, I go to a Japanese bookstore in Singapore, and I just read whatever I could read, and I didn't buy a whole lot, much to their chagrin, I'm sure. But I started to just feel so, how come I didn't know about this? Okay, I was 10 at the time. Okay, fair enough. But still, why wasn't my family talking about this, you know? And as I've learned, for so many reasons, the level of complicity goes so deep. And so if we're willing to say yes to that, all of a sudden now we have to have another conversation about neighbor, globalization, even humanitarian aid, mm-hmm. it seems to me.
For sure.
It kind of changes, I think. Mm-hmm. I think.
And then when there are refugees coming from these regions, hoping to find safe birth in our own countries,
yes.
We're not, like, how could we have the gall to say, you're not our problem?
You're not welcome.
Yeah,
you're not our problem.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there are, you know, and the fiscal conservatives in the room who aren't here today would be probably saying things, well, yeah, but how are we going to afford it?
Yeah.
And what about the work that it's going to take away from my son and so on? I mean, all valid questions, mm-hmm. and we need to address them. But I'm always interested when that's the default.
Yeah.
Right?
And of course, like, they're when probably not going to take...
We go to fiscal responsibility before moral culpability.
Yeah, and they're not going to take those jobs from those people's sons.
Those people's sons.
But you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
There's,
I think maybe that's a new campaign we have. Those people's sons. We have a new campaign developing here, and I'm not sure. Do you think, and I want to talk, I did a little bit more research on you for the interview today, and I love your academic background. I want to talk about that in a second,
sure.
and how that's influenced you as a filmmaker and, frankly, as a storyteller. But do you think time heals everything? I mean, you know, in relation to My Enemy, My Brother, I mean, is that a fair question?
That's a great question. I think, no, time doesn't heal everything. Time gives one the opportunity to start healing. But the process of healing, I think, requires conscious effort and support.
Mm.
You know, that's also where we can be helpful as neighbors to those around us.
So conscious effort and support could be professional, but might just be friendship?
Both, yeah. I find, like, even in the documentary process, I'm not a therapist, but right. just having these conversations with Najah and Zahed helped them start telling their stories and start processing them.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, so just being a listener and then being a supportive listener helped them start to talk about things they hadn't talked about in decades. And that in and of itself, of course, as you know, will start a healing process, right?
I love Become a Supportive Listener. We're kind of defining what a neighbor is.
Mm.
Like I went to proximity, leaning over the fence, out mowing the lawn, you're out doing your roses or whatever, and you get into a conversation about whatever, and before you know, I didn't know that about you. And kind of that whole, you're Iranian, you're Iraqian, are you? There's a beauty and a simplicity to this thing called community that for some reason we're making really hard.
Yeah. Well, it is quite challenging because, I mean, you know, traditionally a neighbor is someone you just kind of, you grow acclimated to. They're physically next to you. You get to see them. You get to know a lot about them before you start talking. And you.
There's an obligation, right?
Yeah.
You have to sort of shovel their sidewalk once in a while.
Yeah, but now you're getting, you know, it is a time of, like, global migration. And so it takes a bit more effort to get acclimated with newcomers. But I think that it's rewarding, and it's, like, for all involved.
Right.
And I think it's just, it should be, it's just a fact of life.
Well, I've always been, I think, at least for the last 20 years or so, I would say, kind of suspicious of the, as I mentioned, the default towards exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, it's the wall, right? The fact that the wall in the U.S. has resonated with so many people is quite remarkable. It's a solution of a sort, I suppose, to some problem. But really, that's what you want to do, and you want to build it higher and thicker, and a wall that you can't even see through, which is remarkable. So not only can air not get through it, you're not going to see any other human, you know. I mean, wow, like, talk about separation. I mean, it is sort of the building of a prison.
Yes.
You know, this is not a border, really, anymore, right?
And the wall, in essence, is a distraction to their real problems, right?
Which
is, you know, the coal mining industry is bottoming out because it's actually not even viable anymore. And so all those communities that are suffering, and not the communities that have relied on that industry, that have unemployment and the despair, gets, you know, sidetracked. Where it's, you know, instead of tackling that head on and facing a realistic approach to how to change that community and bring hope to that community, they're just blaming an other.
Right.
And distracting them with the idea of like, let's put up a wall. Right? Like, you know, let's channel your despair into hatred towards another group
instead
of people.
Instead of talking or in conversation and listening. Yeah. And it's not that simple.
No.
And again, the fiscal conservatives in the room are rolling their eyes at you and I right now. You know that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, great. Those two just think it's about conversation. No, of course not. It goes way deeper than that. But building a wall? Really?
Mm-hmm.
I love the fact. And again, it goes back to that scene where Zahad sees the photo.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure who it was, but said something about the smile touched my heart.
Yes.
The smile touched my heart. The face, the actual physical contact, the community. That again, that neighborliness is what changed the course of these guys' lives and many others.
Mm-hmm. That's something that we talked about also at the UN when we were screening there, which is the power of film or anybody's, you know, documentation of event, whether it's on their smartphones or their cameras.
Right. Yep.
When you can see the people's faces, when you can see people's lives, suddenly it's not just a news story that happens to those people out there, but you just, it hits you that they're just like you, or, you know, the people caught up in whatever conflict or crisis are, you know, just normal people wanting to live their lives just like you and I, but just happen to be on that side of the camera for this news story, you know?
Well, and that seems to be the problem, or one of the many problems we face is this idea of othering, I suppose. You know, a sociologist probably, or a political science would call scientist would call it othering, but the idea that it's them versus us, and we're back to exclusion, we're back to the walls, we're back to keeping out those refugees because they're going to take jobs, etc., away from us. But if we start to see others, you know, in the face, in the smile, in the eyes, and say, we kind of are all in this together. Again, kind of corny in a way, and an oversimplification, but it isn't it the beginning of a new way forward?
I would hope so.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I love what Dion said as well. So it's clearly a bit of a theme here today, but he said, you know, the question in a quote, my enemy, my brother, M-E-M-B, inspires me to think about is the following. Is it possible in the midst of extreme sadness, in the face of absolute horror, in the storm of war, to find a peace in blue sky? You know, we've talked about this already, a ray of hope, trust in humankind. Isn't that kind of, close quote, isn't that kind of what we're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
This little incremental seed planted, drop of water, fertile soil. I don't know. There's lots of metaphors.
It can go far, as we've seen in the Egyptian spring. And, you know, like this, you know, it can be just one person or a small group of people who are aware and conscious and act. And it can engender, you know, such greater ramifications in their community.
Sadly, we're going to have to wrap this up here soon. But I do want you to talk about, if you wouldn't mind, a little bit about the fact that your academic background really has nothing to do with film, in a sense.
When
you read it on the paper, right? Master of Arts degree from U of T in English Lit, BA, U of T in Anthropology.
I love it.
So connected, but not.
Yeah, I could tell you, like, I'll start from the point of view
where
it's not connected. It's like, you know, I wrote about Don DeLillo for my my master's, but also in anthropology, you know, was learning about participant observation and you know, doing field work in communities. So I didn't do a journalism degree. I graduated at a time when, you know, you didn't have to pursue a journalism degree to start getting work in journalism. But I think that in some ways, like, it really did prepare me for my work, because doing a documentary is like anthropology in a sense. You are either, you know, doing an ethnography about a community or a certain sector of society, or you're kind of being a participant observer as a filmmaker, a documentary filmmaker. You're kind of embedded in the lives of your subject.
Right.
And that's kind of the essence of participant observation in anthropology. But in terms of my literature degree, I I love story.
Right.
I love story. And that's what documentaries are all about. It's about finding these stories in real life that are so miraculous or illuminating or just so compelling, you just want to share it. So I find that it probably did prepare me for these careers.
Think, yeah, without a doubt.
But I think if you want to work in this field now, you probably need a J school degree.
Right. Yeah. You probably don't want to, like, what is Terrence Malick was a philosopher.
Right.
He did philosophy before, yeah. You know, it's probably not going to be that.
You can see that discipline. In Tree of Life.
Can you ever?
Yeah.
Is being a good documentary filmmaker, documentarian about connecting those narrative dots?
It is. With any documentary, you're trying to structure some meaning out of just everyday life,
which
often doesn't have a neat beginning, middle, and end, and a nice climax.
Right.
And doesn't.
Nice. Yeah,
and
it's true.
Even with My Enemy, My Brother, it didn't have that nice ending I was hoping for, but we did come to an end. So there's it's an interesting sense of always struggling to make sense of what's happening, what's unfolding, and trying to shape it into a story. And it's a bit like riding the crest of a wave. It's that kind of a taking of a risk where you have a sense of where the wave is going to go, but you're riding the crest of it because you have no control about what's going to happen in real life.
Right.
And
right.
So in that sense, it's a bit of a thrill. It's kind of a risk-taking endeavor.
Sure. I would think any documentarian, I mean, it is all about risks too, right? I mean, there's so many levels and layers of risk. Mm-hmm. Stepping out to actually, you know, mm-hmm. do something like this, which kind of brings me to almost my last question. What's next? I mean, I see on the site that you've got some screenings coming up, but mm-hmm. sort of blank spaces on those screenings, or are the dates there yet?
Yep.
So Toronto, Hague, UN. What's next?
Okay, so My Enemy, My Brother had its theatrical run in Toronto with a VR installation, virtual reality installation. That's for free, and it just takes a person inside the question of when you meet someone in a conflict zone, are you going to trust them or be suspicious of them? Will you collaborate with them or combat them? And it's a series of interesting positions that you find yourself in. So that happened in Toronto. It's going to be in Vancouver in April. And it'll also be in Montreal. And I can give you those exact dates.
Yeah, and we will definitely publish them on the site as well, not only on my site, but on Rabbl. The site is it myenemymybrother.com?
My Enemy, My Brother movie?
It's, anyway, search Anshin, My Enemy, My Brother.
MyEnemyMyBrotherMovie.com.
MyEnemyMyBrotherMovie.com. That's mm-hmm. fantastic. You know, I'm going to quote Najah to sort of wrap this up, and it's really not fair to say this is the wrap-up because it's just the beginning, but, you know, his quote is, it's very hard to get healed, you know. And, I mean, it's just, isn't that a leveling statement?
Yeah.
Like, aren't we all in that place?
Yes.
Families, yeah. Parents,
yeah.
You know, as kids, as friends, yeah. As brothers and sisters, as countries and provinces, the list goes on.
For sure. I mean, even as an individual, just, you know,
yeah.
Getting over childhood hurts.
Yeah.
And you know, from maybe parents who were well-intentioned, but, you know, there may be injuries there or bullying or whatever experiences that people have, experienced here. It is true. Like, the kind of healing work that Najah is trying to do is like anyone trying to heal from past wounds. And, I mean, his story, the stakes are a bit higher.
Right.
But it's I think, equally poignant and it feels equally relevant to people in that regard. It's someone trying to heal from their past and move on in their adult life.
And I think something we all need to pay attention to, Thank you for your time today, Anne, and for, again, a beautiful film, a film that I hope everybody sees and
Thank
I hope
you.
Lives beyond the virtual reality experience and online and wherever it's going to live. Maybe it's going to live academically as well, possibly in some level. But I feel like it's a layered piece. It's a beautiful piece. It's a hopeful film. So thanks for your time today. Anne Chin, talking about her new film, My Enemy, My Brother, here in sunny Toronto.
Thank you, David. It's great talking with you, as always.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.